Hello, I'm Lina Khobodu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we'll discuss the fight against HIV/AIDS. A new UNAIDS report indicates a path to end AIDS. The report, The Path That Ends AIDS, contains data and case studies which highlight that the world can achieve a regeneration, but doing so requires significant political will and sustained financial investment in children, youth, and families. For more insight, I spoke with Charles Chip Lyons, President and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, ECPAF.
Really applaud the report from UNAIDS and the executive director. It really trumpets the key points and the key themes and its conclusion that there is a path to ending the epidemic is one borne out by the evidence, by the work and experience of our organization, the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. And two other specific points, it really places emphasis on leadership as opposed to, say, technical issues, which I can say more about. And it calls out the circumstances for children. They, as a group, lag substantially behind other age cohorts in terms of not getting having access to services sufficient for their needs. And so as a priority population, the UNAIDS report does a good job of calling out how much more needs to be done for kids. So both broadly and specifically, we very much welcome the report from UNAIDS.
After all the years of fighting HIV/AIDS, what measures have proven to be effective?
We know what works, and that's the underlying premise of the report from UNAIDS. When you marshal the right things together, we have seen remarkable progress. So, for example, when communities are directly involved in the response, when marginalized populations receive the support and services they need, you see progress. There's a policy and a legal framework that's conducive to reducing new infections and getting those that have been infected on treatment. We know how that works. And most importantly, it's not in the abstract, you know, from where I'm sitting. Countries are showing the progress that's possible, and they're cited in the report. Rwanda, Namibia, Botswana, Eswatini, Zimbabwe, Tanzania. The evidence is there because those countries have combined the evidence that's available, follow the science, use the data, know your epidemic because it's different in each country. It can be different within different regions of a country. Provide the resources necessary that are commensurate with the challenge at hand in a particular country. Execute programs, support ministries of health. The ingredients, if you will, are known, are proven, are shown in the data in a number of countries. Basis are saying there is a pathway, but it requires leadership. There's a very, I think, crucial line in the report that, given all the evidence and our experience, including at ECPAF, getting onto the path and controlling the epidemic is a choice. Make the decision to end the epidemic, and that choice requires and needs to be made by political leaders. Not just political leaders, but donor leaders, organizational leaders. Do we or do we not intend to control this epidemic? Because the pathway is demonstrable.
So when we talk about political will and the work of the leaders, what needs to be done at this point? If we wanted to pinpoint one particular thing, I know we talked a lot about funding. What about the responsibility on a local level, country level?
Well, I think that's an important part of the leadership that the report is calling for. And those countries that I named earlier that really have shown how the progress that's been made, if you go and look back at what happened in those countries, a common denominator, there's more than one, but one of the common denominators is political leadership. It's a president of a country saying we have to control this epidemic. It's bringing the issue into cabinet meetings. It's holding ministers. It's holding the public. It's accountable. It's drawing in the private sector. It's engaging with communities. It's asking, this political leadership is asking, what policies do we need that we don't currently have that will improve on prevention as well as treatment strategies for our country? At the end of the day, the epidemic will be controlled province by province, county by county, country by country, and that's the most important political leadership. But leadership of organizations, donors and others, the UNAIDS, the Global Fund, PEPFAR, and so on, they also have to create the conditions and create the political will and decide themselves, as PEPFAR has recently done, to prioritize key populations, including underserved populations like children, that when you focus on those populations and you understand what's necessary, the policies, the strategies, and so on, you see the kind of progress that we're trying to achieve globally by 2030. And I would also say on financing, one of the most important points here is a lot of the resources that have been used, including in the countries that have made the most progress, have been very, very reliant on external financing from PEPFAR, from the Global Fund. It's important as a part of the political leadership that increases in domestic financing are made possible over the course of the next number of years. And so, just reminding ourselves on HIV and AIDS, there's not just a finish line and then everyone can relax and, you know, we've accomplished this, tackle the problem and move on. Absent a vaccine or a cure, a key component is the sustainability of the programs and the strategies. And that includes financial sustainability. And that includes a real commitment by countries to increase their investment in their own health systems and in the health and well-being of their people.
According to the report, the path to an AIDS-free generation is anchored in health equity. How so?
Do people have equal rights and access to health services? If the answer is yes, then they will avail themselves of those services, and you will prevent new infections, and you will treat more people who have been exposed to the virus or have the virus. The reverse of that is true. If you don't have a rights-based approach, if there are segments of the population that are denied services or they're discouraged from accessing those services, then the reverse happens. They're not able to have access to those services. Prevention measures are less successful. People who have been exposed or contracted the virus are not accessing those services, which means they're not seen within clinics. They're not properly diagnosed. They're not initiated on treatment. They're not supported so that they stay on treatment. You can call it a rights-based approach, and it is a rights-based approach, but it translates into the daily practice of individuals. Are they stigmatized? Worse, are they put in a position where the laws or other punitive measures suggest that they don't have a right to basic health care and the services that are necessary for their particular situation? That's the basis of that statement by the report.
How does the fight against pediatric AIDS measure in the global goal to achieve the 95-95-95 target?
What's very interesting is since 2010, and that goes back obviously a number of years, one of the real bright spots was how quickly we were able to reduce new pediatric infections and reduce the number of pediatric deaths. It actually gave encouragement to communities and governments and so on that there is a way to tackle the broader HIV and AIDS epidemic. Where that attention has lagged in the past, where children are not a focus particularly, we've seen a slowdown in the reduction of new pediatric infections. We have traditionally had less the tools available for clinicians and others for diagnostics, for example, or antiretrovirals for treatment. For children, they always were suboptimal compared to what was available for adults. That's changed in the last 3 or 4 years. And so we have optimized treatment formulations because of really energetic, good work by the private sector, pharmaceutical companies that are particularly committed, Veev Healthcare, J&J, and others. And so we have much better tools, but if you don't, kids are not just mini adults. Treating a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, getting them tested, being supportive of their caregiver, those are all elements that if you're not focused on them, they're unlikely to be driven and supported in the way that is required. And so at this stage, children as an age group who are living with the virus, so 47% of those kids are not on treatment. It's unconscionable. It's absolutely a doable proposition to get those kids tested, get the test results to the caregiver, and get initiated on pediatric age and weight appropriate ARVs. That's all very doable at this point, but you got to want to do it. You've got to, when you're designing your strategies, you've got to call out kids. Leaders have to call out kids. Okay, you're proposing some policies and strategies. Where are the kids in this? Are their needs being met? Okay, we're putting a budget together for these strategies. Are the resources for children and adolescents in particular, are those resources commensurate with the kinds of activities and the challenges those age groups face? That's what leadership does, is say, we're committed to controlling the epidemic broadly. We're committed to having children receive the services and support that they need so that their levels of testing and treatment and survival and so on are at the same levels as other age groups, and move them to the 90-90-90 targets and the 95-95-90 targets, which, as you know, are about knowing your status, being on treatment, being virally suppressed. I'll say one more thing that is a potential risk if you don't always call out children. Because they are a smaller population group, it's possible to achieve the target of 90-90-90, 90% knowing their status, 90% of those that know their status are on treatment, and 90% that are on treatment are virally suppressed. It's possible to get that those numbers that high and not reach children at the same at the same rates and the same coverage. So you constantly have to ask, where are the kids in this? Are we doing everything we can for their support and for their services, but also to accelerate them because they do lag behind other age groups by a considerable margin.
And to sum up, Mr. Lyons, what should be the priorities moving forward?
We have to continue to find ways to integrate HIV and AIDS services in maternal and child health. I mean, there's a health system, right? And when we emphasize sustainability, one of the most important things is to really integrate and embed HIV and AIDS services into whether it's a universal health care approach or the existing work on maternal and child health. That's a very important priority. This financial sustainability, increased investments by governments broadly in their health systems, But also, you know, we've just come out of COVID. And so a real priority is identifying where additional work could be policies, it could be investments are necessary.
That was Charles Chip Lyons, president and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. On the second part of the program, it is a special conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the former director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci spoke to my colleague Rick Pantaleo of VOA's Science Edition of Press Conference USA. They look back at his career in medicine and public health and discuss his efforts in mitigating pandemics such as HIV/AIDS and COVID-19.
Dr. Fauci, you have played such an important role throughout the COVID-19, HIV/AIDS, and other pandemics, and you are well known throughout the world. I'm sure our audience would like to get to know a bit more about you. Looking back at your career, what are among your most cherished and challenging accomplishments from your work as a doctor, immunologist, director of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, and chief medical advisor to the president?
Well, Rick, I had been at the NIH until recently for literally 54 years, 38 of which I served as the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And during that period of time, I've had the privilege of really wearing three separate but overlapping hats. One is as a individual scientist who ran a basic and clinical research laboratory for all of those years. Next, as the director of one of the largest NIH institutes responsible for the conduct and support of research on virtually all infectious diseases throughout the world, from the common infections that we see here in the United States to global infections like malaria, TB, and HIV. And then thirdly, one that you mentioned in my position involved in policy development, and I'll mention that in just a moment. So if I could just briefly outline the direct answer to your question of what within those three hats I'm most proud of and feel good about. You know, as a scientist, most of the people who know my public image are not aware that I have been a basic and clinical scientist for decades. And I'm proud of the fact that during my career, I have made some, I believe, reasonably important advances, both in the field of autoimmunity, namely a group of diseases that are inflammatory diseases of vessels called the vasculitidae, which back in the 1970s, seems like a long time ago, I and my colleagues developed a therapeutic regimen for a group of diseases such as polyarteritis nodosa and what was originally Wegener's granulomatosis and then has been renamed as polyangiitis with granulomatosis. We developed therapies that made diseases that were essentially uniformly fatal have a remission rate of over 90%. Then when HIV came, I devoted the next 40 years, 40, to trying to delineate the nature of the pathogenic mechanisms of HIV disease, which led to insight into the ultimate development of therapies and understanding the mechanisms of disease. So that's one hat. The other hat, when I became director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in 1984, I did a number of things to elevate the field of infectious diseases, which at the time was really a relatively minor component of NIH, to now the second largest institute, but particularly to develop and create the AIDS program, which together and in collaboration with the pharmaceutical industry, was largely responsible for the development of the entire menu of drugs that have now completely transformed the lives of persons with HIV, to the point of now, it's no longer a death sentence and people could live essentially normal lives. So I feel good about that accomplishment. And then the last was as a policy person, where I've had the privilege of advising seven presidents of the United States, dating back to President Ronald Reagan. And particularly notable was my interaction with President George W. Bush when he tasked me through his own vision and commitment to put together a global program that was involved in getting treatment and prevention for HIV to the developing world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. And that program is now known and has been known. We did it 20 years ago. I started it and was the one of the major architects of it that was established in 2003, called the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And that program has now, 20 years later, been credited with saving 25 million lives globally. And then finally, what you mentioned about COVID, I directed the institute that was responsible, together with the pharmaceutical industry, in developing the highly effective COVID vaccines that clearly now has saved millions of lives worldwide. My team at the Vaccine Research Center, led by Drs. Bonnie Graham and John Mascola and Kizzy Corbett, played a major role in the development of the vaccine. And a number of investigators, Jason McMullen and a bunch of others, all made major contributions, but they were within my institute and overall under my leadership as director of the institute. So all of those things over a very extended career, I feel good about.
Dr. Fauci, I'd like to talk a little bit about each of those highlights you mentioned. First of all, I guess we would talk about something that it seems a lot of people aren't talking about much these days, and that's COVID-19. Now, looking back, once you started to see cases of COVID-19 developing and spreading, what steps did you suggest in mitigating the spread of the disease?
Well, I mean, my job as the director of the institute was the scientific element of the response. So that's what I mentioned just a moment ago, that I mobilized our team at the Vaccine Research Center at NIAID to do something that, in fact, is completely and totally unprecedented in the history of vaccinology. And that is to go from the awareness of the genomic sequence of a brand new virus in early January of 2020, and within days to have a vaccine program going, a phase one trial in 65 days, a phase two trial in 120 days, and then 11 months later to have a vaccine going into the arms of individuals that was highly effective to the tune of 94 to 95% in preventing symptomatic disease and even higher in preventing severity of disease. That was my task, which my institute gladly and aggressively approached. I also was part of the COVID response team at the White House, whose overall responsibility was to guide the public health response. I did not lead that in the Trump administration. I was a member of the task force, but when Biden became president, I became his chief medical advisor.
Dr. Fauci, I've been curious about this for a long time. Your thoughts on doing your work in a very public eye, what was that like?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's unusual for a scientist and a public health official to be so much in the public eye the way I happen to, by circumstances, find myself in. And I learned early on that the only way that you can efficiently do your job is to focus like a laser beam on what your job is, what your mission is, and what your goals are, and to not be distracted by the public element of it, by the fact that you're very well known or that you're on TV or that you're in the newspapers a lot. I mean, that's fine if you're successfully, which I believe we did, spreading scientific truth and evidence for the purposes of promoting the public health. But if you get caught up in that, you get distracted. And I tried as best as I could to just focus on the science and the fundamental principles of public health.
Along with the development and implementation of the vaccines, can you tell us about the many COVID-19 therapies for patients that were developed and refined under your watch, and how many millions of medical professionals were helped by the NIH treatment guidelines in using these interventions?
Well, Rick, that's a good question. So right from the very beginning, the NIAID, our internal scientists, as well as the many, many more grantees that we support throughout the country and in some respects throughout the world, but mostly within the confines of the United States, began developing drugs that already had been developed for other diseases like remdesivir, and began testing them for their efficacy against COVID. And we've partnered with the pharmaceutical companies such as Pfizer, who developed a very good drug called Paxlovid, which is very effective in preventing progression of disease leading to hospitalizations and death, as well as other drugs like Molnupiravir, which we again partnered with the pharmaceutical company. In addition, we were very much involved, as always, partnering with the pharmaceutical companies to develop a group of monoclonal antibodies that at least early on we used successfully both in the prevention and in the treatment of COVID-19. That has been a success story. Unfortunately, the virus tends to mutate and get new variants, which evaded some of the originally successful broadly neutralizing antibodies against COVID. And then there's also the situation of the guidelines that you mentioned. And the guidelines was something that Dr. Cliff Lane and I and outside investigators like Dr. Gulick from Cornell put together to provide a resource to the rest of the country and the world to look in real time at the data on treatment of COVID as it literally came out immediately, rather than waiting for the months that could take for publication, and to advise the community, the clinical community who are taking care of COVID patients, what the most recent science-based and evidence-based data are in a guideline form. So that's what we did in the realm of treatment.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, the former director of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, speaking to my colleague Rick Pantaleo.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. Call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linoch Mudu in Washington, with producer Mukbilia Barrow. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.